With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we're seeing positive market developments for tree nuts, and also why farmer mentors are an important component of the U.S. Regenerative Cotton Fund. But our top story today, other states are gearing up for California's Prop 12, but there are some exemptions allowed for some hog confinement legislation as it goes into effect. David Geiger explains.
Inspections are already starting up around the country in anticipation of California's Proposition 12 law. While officially in effect July 1st, the law requiring animal living condition updates for products like pork to be sold in the state begins in 2024. Michael Formica, legal strategist with the National Pork Producers Council, says inspections are going on.
California has approved 14 or 15 different firms to do these audits, or you can invite California out. I have heard of a couple of producers who have asked for California to come out and inspect their farm.
The most recent USDA report says animal confinement legislation nets compliant pork an average $4.94 a hundredweight premium. When it comes to Prop 12 enforcement for that premium, Formica says there are some updates.
California has exempted ground meat because it's not a whole pork. It's not a whole cut of pork from Proposition 12. So ground product would not be covered. Sausage would not be covered.
In frozen food, NPPC negotiated to make sure any products in the supply chain sold before July 1st could still be sold. However,
January 1, that will no longer be allowed to be sold in California.
Formica does not think there will be any more delays. The law will be fully implemented. And one big concern across industries,
if you are a grocery store operator in California, if you're a consumer in California, you're already dealing with record food price inflation that has been going on. We have seen in California, price of pork is up significantly. Come January 1, I suspect that that jumps up some more.
Formica adds 60% of grocery sales in California are from small, independent-run grocers.
Those generally don't have access to compliant pork, and so we're watching that marketplace as well.
I'm David Geiger.
The findings from USDA's premier ag data collection survey will become available early this year, offering a snapshot in time regarding U.S. agriculture. Here's Rod Bain.
The results will soon be available to the public. The findings of USDA's 2022 Census of Agriculture.
We're looking for a good product to be available on the 13th of February.
That from Joe Prusacki of the Agriculture Department's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Now, some might wonder why a census, where data was collected in late 2022 and early 2023, is being released in early 2024.
It takes all of 23 to compile data from between 2 and 3 million farmers, so it takes a while.
And in fact, some people not familiar with how the Census of Agriculture works seem to have plenty of questions about a survey that has plenty of questions in it. For instance,
I think the biggest question is, why do you mail out or try to collect data from 3+ million farmers? And whereas the farm count in the United States is about 2 million. Why? Well, because farmers are in and out, so you don't necessarily cash. That's one. The other thing is people ask is, why do you do it? Trust me, it's not cheap to do a census of agriculture. And why do you do it? It's to get that benchmark, that snapshot of what's going on in the United States.
The census, every 5 years, does create that snapshot in time regarding agriculture. Essential, according to Prusacki, in that
my first sense of agriculture with USDA NAS was in 1997. Things have changed dramatically in the world of agriculture since then, and in that census you can track it through and see what's going on county by county to see what's happening. And there's a lot of people other than, I use the word ag, I'm air quoting ag people, that look at the census.
He uses the following example to illustrate the point.
Somebody says, oh hey, I'm not a farmer, but you know, it does impact you because the census has data in there that industry folks, they'll look at and they'll say, you know what, based on these information, it looks like maybe there's a bunch of small farms coming into this particular area, this particular county. Maybe we'll put a store in here. Well, what does that do? It brings jobs. It brings tax money to your local area. So it does help.
The timing of the release of the 2022 Census of Agriculture results coincides with a major USDA event that same week.
100th year of the Ag Outlook Forum, NAS, we have two sessions related to the census going on, so we will be able to share the information with the broader agriculture community that's at that event on specific topics.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
We will return in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. We go now to Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm visiting with Randy Minton with Pivot Bio. And Randy, first of all, tell me what you do.
I am the head of commercial sustainability at Pivot Bio. Pivot Bio provides growers a technology opportunity to deliver a better form of nitrogen. That better form of nitrogen really comes from microbes that we've developed that continuously fix atmospheric nitrogen. It's applied to the root of the crop, so those microbes populate, fix nitrogen on the roots, and deliver ammonia directly into the plant. The benefit of that delivery system is that it creates a sustainability benefit in that 100% of the nitrogen that's fixed by the microbe is taken up by the crop. In comparison, synthetic nitrogen, we know today, we lose 40 to 60% of the applied synthetic nitrogen that's applied to fields. So when you think about an opportunity with a better form of nitrogen that is taken up by the plant, does not leach, does not run off, does not volatilize, you can create a sustainability benefit for the grower and for companies interested in addressing their environmental footprint.
So, innovator, tell me a little bit about this and, you know, what is the value in it?
So the Innovator Program is really designed to work with growers on that nitrogen, synthetic nitrogen replacement with Pivot Bio. We work with them to outline fields, to capture a comparison of their prior practice use of synthetic and the change that they have adapted in use of Pivot Bio. What that does is we can model that data and create data that tells us how much greenhouse gas, for example, that we have avoided or reduced from that farm.
So in the process of this, you are able to do validation, able to do tracking, and those are critical parts of the program, right?
That is correct. We go through a whole process of really doing quality control work on the data that farmers provide. We validate the program and the protocols that we use, and we verify that the data is accurate from the grower. So when you package all of this up in a verified fashion, what we're really focused on for the next few years is trying to develop inset programs with downstream ag companies. And what do I mean by that? It's really about partnering with grain companies, consumer packaged good companies, retail, integrated livestock, even biofuels, to work together to provide an intervention or an investment back to growers that are really adopting sustainable practices on the farm. So specifically use of Pivot Bio, reduction of synthetic nitrogen, we can develop a program with these downstream companies, communicate that back to our growers, enroll them, and really work to deliver both sustainably produced grains and a complete outcome with data for the downstream companies that really help them understand how they've addressed their Scope 3 emissions inside of their supply chain. Inside of that outcomes report is not only the calculation on greenhouse gas avoided or reduced, but also how much water have we preserved by not going through a Haber-Bosch process. It takes 3.4 gallons of water to produce a single pound of nitrogen, for example. The other thing that we highlight in our outcomes is a reduction in nitrate leaching, which is significant from the farm. So all of those together create a complete package of environmental benefits for the downstream companies. It's something they're willing to invest in and really drive through the farmer. We can package it all up and bring farmers together with downstream companies.
So for the farmers, who are they working with in order to be a part of this?
Yeah, so Pivot Bio sales reps are in a great position to help their customers or their Pivot Bio growers understand the opportunity around these programs. They help them get their data submitted into a portal, a grower portal that we operate through Pivot Bio, and they help them along the way in regard to how to package that data and what it is we need to capture for the complete data that we need to support those downstream programs. So reps are key in this, and I think with the support of reps, we've had significant uptake in our program. We've been running this program for 2 years. The first year, 2022, our pilot year, we were shocked at the number of acres where we collected data. It was over 500,000 acres that we collected in 2022. And we've grown that to over 1 million acres in 2023. We've got 4 downstream inset programs running for 23, with 6 different downstream companies involved. So we're having really good success in the initial years of creating inset opportunities for our supply chain.
Well, before we close, anything else you might want to talk about?
I think for the future, I think the entire program for us is going to be geared towards really creating value along our entire supply chain for corn, grain sorghum, wheat, barley, whatever grain crop that we operate on from a Pivot Bio perspective. We believe that we have the capability to create really strong partnerships, really great opportunities for growers, and we want to make sure that the majority of that revenue coming from those programs flows back to the grower for a complete value package from Pivot Bio.
All right, well, thank you very much, Randy Minton with Pivot Bio, for talking with me here at the Farm Broadcasters Convention. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
In today's livestock news, we discussed yesterday how California's Prop 12 will impact the U.S. pork industry and California consumers. Beyond the Golden State, pork supplies are looking to tighten as well. Increased cost of production and low returns has pushed some hog producers towards an interesting solution. A new report indicates that hog producers are trying to raise prices by keeping a lid on output. USDA's Gary Crawford has more.
It appears the nation's hog producers are trying to keep a lid on production and get hog prices up by reducing farrowings and balancing that out with more pigs per litter.
That is largely what appears to be happening.
USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum, he bases that on USDA's new quarterly hogs and pigs report. It shows farrowings down 4% in the September to November quarter, with pigs per litter up 4%. Producers also say they intend to cut farrowings this quarter by 2% and the next quarter by 1%.
Their returns have been weak. They've been looking at relatively low hog prices. We have seen declining corn prices, but for the most part, I think that they're looking at, you know, having seen hog prices that were at or below break even, and that's sort of conditioning them to pull in the reins on production.
And that is backed up by more than just the USDA numbers.
If we look at producer returns, Iowa State University measures farrow finished returns. And they have, for this year, they have been negative since January, with the exception of just 2 months in July and August, with fairly sharp declines in October and November. So again, that is largely probably conditioning what producers were thinking in terms of, you know, not wanting to get too far ahead in terms of an expansion.
The report shows the breeding inventory December 1st down 3% from a year ago. The total hogs and pig inventory, 75 million head, up less than 1% from last year. USDA's most recent forecast for pork production projects pork output for 2024 will top this year by a small amount, about 1.5%. USDA projects hog prices will average $60 a hundredweight next year, up from this year by $1.30, but that's just 2% higher than 2023. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
While there's still some challenges on the demand side for almonds, there have been some positive market developments on the supply side. Senior analyst covering fruits and tree nuts for Rabo Agri Finance, David Magana, highlighted the outlook for 2024.
Seems like we put all the logistic challenges behind us, and we hope to continue to see these transportation costs going down to a reasonable level, and also good availability of containers. So that is like probably when we don't discuss that, that's a good sign. It's like in football, you don't discuss about the offensive line unless they've made a mistake, right? Also, another factor is input prices. We are expecting that going into 2024, still the affordability index will be in positive territory. So that's another piece of good news. But as I said, most of the challenges are now concentrated on the demand side.
The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission have released new guidelines for reviewing company mergers and acquisitions. Culminating from a two-year public engagement process, the guidelines reflect contemporary market realities and legal advancements in an effort to protect fair competition. The guidelines address the need for fairness in the market with prices, employment terms, and platform competition. While not legally binding, the guidelines provide insight into the agency's decision-making process. The robust development process involved public comments, workshops, and revisions, with over 30,000 comments received from business owners, workers, and other advocates in industries ranging from food and agriculture to healthcare. While not prescriptive, the guidelines inform agencies' investigations, guided by prosecutorial discretion and judgment based on case-specific facts. California's 2019 overtime law for ag workers appears to have since resulted in reduced weekly working hours and earnings for crop workers. The findings are highlighted in a recent R update from the University of California Giannini Foundation of Agricultural Economics using data from the National Agricultural Workers Survey. It reveals a substantial reduction in weekly working hours and earnings for California crop workers. Employers adjusted schedules to avoid higher overtime rates, leading to challenges in achieving the purported objective of the legislation. The study shows a decrease in workers getting just under the old threshold of 60 hours and an increase in those working between 46 and 50 hours, which is under the new overtime requirement. The research estimates a collective 15,000 to 45,000 fewer hours worked and between $6 and $9 million less in weekly pay for California's crop workforce in the law's initial 2 years. Growers have a variety of different resources available to them through the U.S. Regenerative Cotton Fund. Jessica Kelton with the Soil Health Institute said an important component of the overall effort to help support the implementation of cover crops in cotton is the availability of farmer mentors.
We try to take every opportunity we have to highlight those really innovative growers that have made these practices work. And we usually do this at field events. We try to have a field event in every state or every region we're working in and highlight what those growers are doing so farmers can plug into those events and hear what's working, what's not working, and what growers are actually able to do on farm. And another piece of that, too, is if you're just starting out and you're looking to do cover crops and maybe you're not getting any incentive payments through NRCS or another project, we have a payment up to $1,200 for growers to implement cover crops on up to 40 acres. So that's another way to get involved and maybe try out cover crops if you've not done it yet.
The 2024 Vineyard Dormant Season Management Field Day is coming up soon in Fresno. The program will begin at 8 in the morning at Golden State Vintners in Fresno on Friday, January 12th. Cooperative Extension Viticulture Advisor for Fresno County, George Zhuang, will begin the event with a presentation on the effect of variety, cordon height, and irrigation on mechanically pruned vineyards in the southern San Joaquin Valley. There will also be a discussion on dormant season weed management in vineyards, and Viticulture Advisor for Madera, Merced, and Mariposa counties, Carl Lund, will be talking about dormant season disease management. San Joaquin County Viticulture Advisor Justin Tanner will also be discussing the effects of trellis and irrigation on grape production in the northern San Joaquin Valley. There will also be field demos from VMEC, Spagnolo, and Beagle Technologies. More information about the field day can be found on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Help for specialty crop producers with food safety certification costs. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
Now available for specialty crop growers. Assistance with on-farm food safety program expenses.
That are going for obtaining or renewing their food safety certification for calendar years 2022 and 2023.
USDA Farm Service Agency Georgia State Director Arthur Tripp says application for the Food Safety Certification for Specialty Crops program is open until January 31st through local FSA offices.
Producers can complete complete the FSA 888 form, which is the application. And any producer can go into our service centers across the country to receive more information.
Another information resource is through the web address farmers.gov/food-safety. Among the areas of assistance covered under the Food Safety Certification for Specialty Crops Program, developing or maintaining food safety plans, certification costs, and microbiological training. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Food prices in 2024 may do something they haven't done in several years. Gary Crawford has more.
Over the last 20 years or so, food prices at the grocery store have gone up each year by an average of around 2%. That is considered a normal rate of food price inflation. But of course, in 2022, food prices at the grocery store made big news by increasing an average of just under 11.5%. This current year, 2023, it looks like prices will rise about 5%. So what about 2024 coming up?
Food prices are expected to continue to decelerate or slow in 2024.
In fact, USDA says they could descend enough to make news again, but news of a different kind there. Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer told us.
Food at home prices.
That's food bought at the grocery store.
Are predicted to decrease 0.6% in 2024.
Down by 0.6%, down below 2023. And the news story from that is this.
So the last time we saw a decline in food prices at the grocery store, an annual decline, was in 2017.
2017, 7 years ago. So what's brought on this food price reversal? Megan says let's go back then to 2021 and 22 and take a look there.
So really in 2021 and 2022, the economy was still dealing with disruptions due to COVID, supply chain issues, and compounded by the war in Ukraine. And so throughout 2023 here, price effects of those shocks have really eased over the year, and supply chain pressures have eased significantly.
Also, prices for what it takes to produce food and bring it to us, those prices have dropped quite a bit also.
So energy prices are down 5.4% over the year. Gas prices are down almost 9%, and prices for unprocessed farm commodities are down almost 15%.
Opening up this rare chance for a 2024 in which grocery store food prices at least have a chance of coming in below 2023. Now, if I sound excited about that, it's because I am. But Megan says I should not get too excited. I need to calm down. Don't get too excited just yet.
We are quite a ways out from the end of next year.
So grocery store food price possibilities actually range from going down by as much as 5% or up by about 4.5%. A big range of possibilities there, which Megan says will narrow as we work our way through this next year. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Active weather in general occurred during most of 2023 across the nation. Rod Bain takes a look back.
Among the top weather stories for 2023, per USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey, multiple severe weather outbreaks around the nation, which led to, by Christmas,
82 tornado-related fatalities in the United States. We have seen multiple deadly tornado outbreaks this year.
With tornadoes reported from January 12th until December 9th.
And we saw quite a number of significant severe weather outbreaks, not just tornadoes, but also high winds and hail lasting all the way into early summer. We got a little break, but then we saw a couple of autumn outbreaks.
In regards to the high tornado-related fatality count for 2023,
that is the most since 2021, when we had that big December outbreak in Kentucky and neighboring states. And before that, the deadliest tornado year since 2011, when we saw a modern record 553 tornado-related deaths.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And a relatively quiet U.S. wildfire season in 2023 contained one dramatic incident this summer on one of the Hawaiian Islands. Here's Rod Bain once again.
What are the top weather stories in our country for 2023? On USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey's list,
we're going to have to go outside the contiguous U.S. to Hawaii,
where a significant wildfire on the island of Maui was
the deadliest U.S. single wildfire in more than a century since some of the Great North Woods fires back in the early 20th century across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and neighboring states in the upper Midwest. Current death toll there is 100 individuals.
The Lahaina fire occurred in August, and compared to the devastation caused by that single fire event,
that came in an overall fairly quiet wildfire season for the United States as a whole, and gets to the point that even in an overall quiet season, whether you're talking about wildfires or hurricanes, you can still have a single or a couple of very devastating events.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Chuck Zimmerman has an update from the Renewable Fuels Association.
I'm visiting with Robert White with the Renewable Fuels Association. And Robert, since we're getting towards the end of the year, I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of where are we at on the E15 front for ethanol?
Well, so it's a two-pronged approach right now. We obviously have the eight Midwest governors that are still waiting for a rulemaking to happen from EPA. Requesting them their ability to opt out of the E10 waiver, which essentially puts gasoline on a level playing field, no matter if you blend E10 or E15 with it. The reverse is happening in Congress, and that is to extend the one-pound waiver that E10 has enjoyed for decades to E15. And so at the end of the day, we don't care which effort happens. We just need one to happen before next summer, because we can't rely on emergency waivers year after year after year, because there are parameters that those have to meet, guidelines, and ultimately 3 years in a row will be a tough lift.
So in an ideal situation, something would get decided before the end of the year, since then we're in a, you know, an election year.
Right. And of course, as we know, E15 lowers the price of fuel. So that's a great talking point. The problem is the petroleum companies are saying the opposite. If you disrupt the supply chain, then we'll have the reality is we've done the math. We've actually utilized three different firms that the petroleum companies use, and we show, you know, in most cases, a penny or two difference. Well, that's washed away with the value proposition of ethanol, and by the time you do RINs and margins and included. So we have no concern about raising fuel prices. In fact, we've saw this year again, emergency waivers saved consumers billions at the pump thanks to the supply addition of ethanol.
Is there anything else that can be done right now to try to help move that along?
Well, I encourage everyone to, you know, as always, talk to your elected officials and ask them to support year-round E15. It is the number one issue. We've been, unfortunately, fighting this for over a decade now, and everyone, including our elected officials, are tired of it, and they want to get it done so we can focus on bigger and better things. But in the meantime, it's always talk to your elected officials. Thank them when they do well and remind them when they don't.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Robert, for giving us a little update on where we stand on the E15 issue. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here is Cindy Zimmerman with today's featured interview.
We're here at the tail end of the Ag Gateway annual meeting in Nashville. With me is Brent Kemp, president and CEO of Ag Gateway. And Brent, how do you think the meeting went?
When people ask me that, I always turn that around and ask them, how do you think the meeting went? And so far, everyone has said it has been a great meeting. Our attendance numbers were up over last year, which were up over the year before. We're on a great trajectory. We've had great speakers, great engagement with the members who are present, just wonderful conversations all around. We came in, we knew we were closing out several working groups earlier. We were kind of scratching our heads, what was next? I think we're going to have six working groups come out of this meeting. And that can only be good for the organization. So I think it's been a great conference.
One of the big topics was getting into animal agriculture. Are some of the new working groups going to be tied into that?
Probably so. We're still early days with animal ag right now, but I believe that first quarter, first half at the latest of next year, we're going to have an animal ag working group or two.
Definitely a lot of interest in that at this, for sure. Well, embracing our data-driven future, what does that mean to you?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and it's more than just a tagline, right? Mm-hmm. All of this conference, we've talked about the ways that data is going to change our lives more than it already has, and more than we even think about in a day-to-day context. Brooks Hamilton, our speaker on AI on Monday, really challenged us to think about data in a new way and think about the ways we generate data and the data we as individuals generate impacts not just our lives but also our businesses. As I've wandered the floor, as I've listened to conversations and engaged in conversations, people are thinking about data and the way it interacts with their business processes in a new way. We've done a great job as an industry coming together on making electronic supply chain processes a reality. We've done a great job as an industry making electronic data that's captured in the field readily available. And now we need to bridge that gap. We need to have the clean handoff between supply chain and field operations to have that data-driven future that we're all talking about, whether it's sustainability, traceability, climate smart, carbon neutral. Data is going to be central to that. And that's really what we're encouraging our members to embrace.
Ag Gateway develops resources for your members, and you've got, constantly growing that. What are some of the ones that are coming out that you're especially, you think are going to generate a lot of interest?
I think the biggest news out of this conference is that the ADAPT standard, which will be a specification separate from the ADAPT toolkit, but still based on that data model, the ADAPT standard version 1, once it's published and released, CNH has committed to making that their export file format moving forward. We're really excited about that. We're grateful for that announcement and that support, and we look forward to seeing where that goes in the future. We anticipate that more organizations will be taking a look at that and looking at that in a very serious way. That's the biggest news I think we have coming out of this conference. Of course, we always are publishing enhancements and developing enhancements for our Ag Industry Identification System, AGIS. We went over 7 or 8 different enhancements that went in this year, ranging from just some basic password security updates to real changes in how users interact with the system and the data that underpins it. So just because we don't have a new release doesn't mean that those existing resources aren't being updated to meet the needs of subscribers and members today.
One of the things you do here at the annual meeting is give out some awards and recognize some of the people who do work for Ag Gateway. Your President's Award was given out first. Tell me a little about the gentleman who you chose for that award.
So we had a team from NIST, National Institutes of Standards and Technology, that have worked to develop a standards navigator tool that had previously been called SCORE and now is called Connect Spec. And what this allows organizations and the developers within them to do is readily understand a business message schema, produce sample documents, produce the mapping that they need to translate internal data to an industry standard or vice versa. Previously, that was all done with spreadsheets, if it was done that way at all. We had a great tool prior to this that was Windows-based. It was good, but it was limited in terms of what standards that it supported. And this tool just takes us light years beyond what we could do before. So we're very appreciative of the work that Evan, Hakju, and CIRM did to get this tool out the door.
All right, so the next awards were the Ag Gateway in Action Awards, and you had those from not only the United States, but also from Latin America and where else?
Europe.
And Europe, of course. So tell me a little bit about the purpose of that award and what you're recognizing, who you're recognizing.
Yeah, the Ag Gateway in Action Award has been presented to individuals and organizations who materially move the mission of Ag Gateway forward, whether that's through implementing resources and encouraging others to do so, or whether it is evangelizing the organization in some way. acting as a leader in a region. And that is important, is we're recognizing that this is a regional award. It covers all of Ag Gateway, and it showcases that we are truly global.
Well, and you have two other awards that are named after people who have helped a lot in the formation of Ag Gateway. One, the Ron Storms Award, and Stuart Ray with Syngenta was awarded that. Tell me the background of that award and why you chose Stuart this year.
So the Ron Storms Award, it recognizes volunteer leadership within the organization. Ron was an employee of CF Industries. He was an early advocate of not just electronic messaging in the fertilizer space, but also recognizing and advocating for business-to-business collaboration. So in a real sense, he was one of the early leaders of electronic connectivity that led to Ag Gateway. Ron passed away, unfortunately, in the early 2000s, I believe, and we recognize folks in his memory. So we look for individuals who showcase several of Ron's characteristics, including leadership, volunteerism, honesty, integrity, and Stuart has absolutely showcased that over the course of his engagement with Ag Gateway. He's a leader in the ADAPT group, in agri-semantics, in anything that touches field operations and makes life better for those organizations who are dealing directly with growers and producers. He has been just a wonderful advocate for the work that gets done both within his organization and outside of Syngenta and Ag Gateway, and couldn't be prouder to recognize him with this award.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Brent. Here at the Ag Gateway Annual Meeting in Nashville, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
Thank you, Cindy. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. The 2023 growing season provided some remarkable results. Here's Gary Crawford.
2023 certainly brought us some surprises along the agricultural way. USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer says among those surprises,
overall crop yields pretty darn good for corn and soybeans, for instance, on a crop that didn't really have all that favorable of growing conditions.
In fact, at harvest time, one Iowa corn grower told us,
it's remarkable the yields that we're pulling out given the limited rainfall we had.
And of course, Seth Meyer says, despite some very hot, very dry weather over much of the country,
we had crops and yields just slightly below trend, just a little bit below trend. Below trend, yes, but just a little bit below trend. But given the farmers' response to the demands for corn early on, we had a record large corn crop.
15.2 billion bushels, truly remarkable. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And once again, our top story today, California's Proposition 12. There's a lot of uncertainty in the new year for U.S. pork producers around the nation as California's Prop 12 takes effect. Chad Smith has more on the loss of a big market for many producers.
California's Prop 12 goes into effect with the new year on January 1st. It becomes California state law during a time of already great uncertainty in the pork market. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Bernt Nelson talks about the current pork market conditions.
We've got some bearish fundamentals going on in the pork market. We just had the USDA's quarterly hogs and pigs report released. We found out that we've still got quite a few hogs in the inventory. The breeding inventory was up 3% from this time last year. So what this means is we have more hogs in the market than we have demand.
Nelson adds that California's Proposition 12 is about to throw another wrench into the market.
California possesses about 13% of the demand for U.S. pork. And when Prop 12 goes into effect, we lose that 13% demand from the conventional marketplace. Now that we're facing a decreased inventory in the beef market, that leaves us asking, when will consumer demand start to pick up for pork products, or will they, as pork is a very close substitute to our beef prices?
He says there's still a lot of uncertainty about how the market will adjust after January 1st.
I don't know that there is a lot to be done with regards to Prop 12. The fact that it takes effect on January 1 leaves so many people asking questions and very little to actually do to prepare for it. When this takes place, the only pork that will be allowed for sale in that California market will have to be compliant with Prop 12. So So that automatically removes many of our conventional producers from that marketplace. And so until we see some increased demand domestically and continued demand in our export markets, we are going to be at the mercy of whatever comes into play here.
Chad Smith, Washington.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.